Hey, Bill, I don't know if you remember back to when you were about 8 or 9, 10 maybe. You and I were probably different than these guys up here, because they didn't have to go through this at all, but you and I probably did. Remember when you were on the playground? Hey, girls, this is the same as the guys. We used to pick teams. You know, we'd be playing baseball or football or soccer or something, and we'd be picking teams, and you know who they would pick as the captains, right? The biggest, the fastest, the bestest kind of guys. And there'd be two of them, and there'd be one here and one there, and then, you know what they would do next? They would start picking teams. I'll take you. Oh, yeah? Well, I'll take that guy. Really? Well, I'll take him. And back and forth, and back and forth, and back and forth. And when I was 8 or 9, it was usually, all right, I'll take him. Right down to the bottom of the pile, right? Somebody's got to get picked last. I remember what it felt like. You felt about this big. It's probably because you were just a little bigger than that, right? And your value was just diminished. Somehow you weren't enough. You weren't part of the team. You didn't have a role to play. And what you did is inside you'd get all turned up, and what you'd say is, I'm going to show them. I'll work harder, try harder. I'll play bigger than I really am. And of course, the harder we tried on the field, the worse it seemed to get. Those were hard times. Remember one day, I couldn't have been more than 8. And I was having one of those sort of, I knew we were going to go play after school and summon up the courage because I wanted to play. But this day it was something different. One of the guys had brought either his big brother or his cousin or something, and I must have thought the guy was so old. He probably wasn't more than 17, 18, or 19. His name was Guy. The guy came out to the park and somehow, some way, some reason, I don't know, he liked me. And every time in the future when Guy would come and play with us, I was out of my mind with excitement because Guy would come up and go, I choose camp. Now, it cost him. I mean, there's no question. I might have been under illusions then, but not now, that Guy, you know, had to sort of try harder himself to make up for me. He said, I choose you, and I want you on my team, and I've got a special job for you. And I felt like $1 million. One of the problems for us as Christians is I think we live in the reality of saying, I don't have anything to offer. I'm smaller. I'm insufficient. I can't do this. And somehow we've heard this message that we're not good enough to be chosen. When Peter comes along, he says, Cam, that's not a new problem for you or even for this generation. That's been a part of the issue for my people all the way from the beginning of time. And Peter comes and he says, guess what? God chose you. Here we are in this series, Everyday Church. We're into chapter 2 of 1 Peter. And right in verse 9, the very pivotal point of our talk today, the pivotal point, Peter says, but you are a chosen people. You, Marty. Jesus chose you. You, Mark, Jesus chose you. He didn't care about all the things that we'd messed up on. He didn't care about all those things, whether we were good enough for this or bad enough for that. You know, he just said, I choose you. That's what Peter's telling us. That very word he used there. The word in the original means, it's genes, or it means genesis, beginnings, origins, roots. He says each and every one of you had roots somewhere. In Robson Park this morning, we celebrated, we dedicated Mila, Guy and Julie, second child, second baby. Here she is, and we dedicated her and ourselves to the Lord in raising her. And then the other end of the spectrum, my mom and dad were there. It's a special weekend for them. 50th wedding anniversary yesterday. It was just such a neat thing to have them there this morning, because my story, Graham's story, Heather's story, all originates from Bob and Brenda. I mean, Peter says it. He says it quite clearly in chapter 1, verse 23. But you, once, he said, once, Cameron, you were born of perishable seed. Now, we don't need biology lessons. We know what he's talking about there. Once upon a time, there was Bob and Brenda, and oh, look at that. 9 months later, here comes Cameron. Once, he says, you were born of perishable seed, but now, now you have a new story, a new beginning, a new origin, a new roots, a new dad. He says, because now you're born of imperishable seed. You have a new father and a new family. Why? Because he chose you. He chose us, which is even better than just choosing me. We're his team. We're his family. Those of us that sometimes in our life have thought we're not good enough, we're rejects, we're not part of this. Peter says, no, 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 no. He chose you. He chose you to build his church. Go back with me to verses 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. In that whole section there in chapter 2, we hear this story of how Jesus himself was rejected in verse 7. He was rejected, but he's become the capstone or the cornerstone. The stone the builders rejected has become the very foundation of this house that he's building. If you've ever been to my house, you knew that a couple of years ago we had a linoleum kitchen floor that had been around for a long time. A long, long time. It was horrible. Disgusting. And it was time. It was time to replace that thing. And so Shelley and I sort of thought around, and we looked and we discussed and we debated and we said, you know what, we're going to do it. We're going to put this slate floor in. And we had to go get boxes of these tiles. And what you did is when you opened up the boxes, you looked at each and every single tile. And some of them you went, no, I don't think that looks so good. And you rejected them. You put them in another pile. These ones we'll use. Those ones we won't. And Peter says, that's the picture. That what Jesus did is he came and he went to the reject pile. The world looks at us and says, well, you're big enough, you can go on my team. You're fast enough, you can go on my team. You're sort of a good quality person. We'll have you there. Jesus came along and he says, I know what it's like to be rejected. I'm building this different kind of thing, and I choose you. You know, there's some implications for that. It's one thing to be chosen, but it's another thing to live as if we're chosen. Paul says in 1 Corinthians 6:19, that we are purchased, we've been bought. Do you not know you've been bought at a price? The precious blood of Jesus. It cost him everything to put you in his family, to put you on his team. Sometimes the biggest problem for us as Christians is that we don't understand our identity. And the reason, or one of the ways we don't understand it is we say, oh yeah, to be a Christian means I get this free gift. Well, it is free, but hang on a second. It cost Jesus everything. And I want to tell you that if you've got this mentality that says, well, it cost him everything, but it's free for me and I don't have to do anything, you're wrong. You were told a lie. It cost you everything. Because part of being purchased means I die to everything that used to give me value. And now I've been born again into a new family. And now my story, my origins, my roots are wrapped up not in what I do, but what he does, what he's done. Not only have we been purchased, but in Romans, Paul says, you've been made to be heirs, co-heirs with Christ. Chapter 8, verse 17. He's put you on his team. He's made you part of his family. Your story has its origins there, and now your value comes because he's purchased you and made you to be a child of God. Thirdly, he doesn't leave you there. 2 Corinthians chapter 5, Paul says, he's made us to be ambassadors. I don't know how to say this gently. I'm trying. But I think one of the saddest things that could ever happen to us as Christians is that we think that, yeah, to be a Christian means that I've accepted Jesus and I've been made his child, so far so good, but I'm going to stop there. He says, no, I made you a child so that you might become an ambassador. And sometimes people sit on the bench. They've been picked to be part of the team. They've been chosen. They've been given a task and they stay there. Don't play their role. Jesus says, no, I send you. As the Father has sent me to tell you this good news that you're chosen, so I send you. Well, I want you to reflect on that word, Genesis, new beginnings, new origin, new dad, as we sing this next song.
We do this journey together. Some high points and some low points. We're always trying to figure out, interpret, listen carefully to what is it that Jesus is calling us to. Maybe we don't always get it right, but I hope we can have a bit of fun in some of those moments.
Sometimes we have a little bit distorted view of who Jesus is, don't we? You know, there's some scriptures that will help us, I think, to do a little bit better job than that video of understanding Christ's call to be obedient. So let's hear this second round of scriptures about being obedient.
Therefore, if you have any encouragement from being united with Christ, if any comfort from his love, if any common sharing in the Spirit, if any tenderness and compassion, then make my joy complete by being like-minded, having the same love, being one in spirit and of one mind. Do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit. Rather, in humility, value others above yourselves, not looking to your own interests, but each of you to the interests of the others.
Dear friends, let us love one another. For love comes from God. Everyone who loves has been born of God and knows God. God. Whoever does not love does not know God, because God is love. This is how God showed his love among us. He sent his one and only Son into the world that we might live through him. This is love, not that we loved God, but that he loved us and sent his Son as an atoning sacrifice for our sins. Dear friends, since God so loved us, we also ought to love one another. No one has ever seen God, but if we love one another, God lives in us, and his love is made complete in us.
Devote yourselves to prayer, being watchful and thankful, and pray for us too, that God may open a door for our message, so that we may proclaim the mystery of Christ, for which I am in chains. Pray that I may proclaim it clearly as I should, be wise in the way you act toward outsiders, make the most of every opportunity, let your conversation be always full of grace. See the Lord so that you pray.
There are moments when you don't want to talk, you know, you just want to wait for a moment. Holy moments, and I knew it would be hard for me to play all the way through that because you got to sing that last. Yahweh, he chose us, cost him everything, put us on his team, make us part of his family, send us. New dad, new family. And Peter continues and he says, not only are you a chosen people, but you're a royal priesthood, a holy nation, which basically means I want to be like my dad. I don't know if you can see that. It's pretty old. 1971. Any guesses? Me with my dad. I was six. Dad was a pastor. He'd been quite a soccer player, so you know where I get my soccer stuff from. I didn't really want to be a pastor, but you know, when you're a little kid, you want to grow up to be like dad. And that's what Peter's grappling with here in this text. He says, Cam, not only did Jesus choose you, but he gave you a new family, a new dad, and this royal priesthood, holy nation stuff. The word is ethnos, and what it means is have the character of your dad. Be like dad. We are so fortunate. Jesus came not just to die on the cross and to be raised again so that we might have new life. Jesus came to live, or put a different way, Jesus came to be a demonstration on earth of how to live so that in everything we bear witness to who our dad is. We're like dad. Jesus came to say, I want you to see my dad. Therefore, I do everything that he's doing. You know, sometimes we know, hey, you know what? Jesus was like his dad. Jesus was like the Father. But actually, in looking at Jesus, we can see God. We can see what God's like because that's who Jesus was. He took on flesh. He became one of us to live out, to be a witness of what his dad is like. All through history, God has been working in and through his people, us, to demonstrate, to bear witness to who he is by the way that we live. We can see it all through the text. We go all the way back to Genesis chapter 12 and we see the covenant between Abraham and God. I will make you into a great nation. I will bless you. And thirdly, I will bless all nations on account of you. You will be a blessing. In other words, they will see God by the way in which you live among them. We come to Moses in the Old Testament. God gives the law. Now, the law wasn't there to make us a bunch of prudes, to sort of shrivel our life and to make it restricted. The law was there so that we might live fully, a demonstration of who God the Father is, that we would bear witness to him. Jesus comes in the New Testament and he says, I am a fulfillment of the law. I've not come to do away with it at all, but I've come to show you how you live so that you bear witness to Dad. Empower you so that you may bear witness. Be like Dad. Everything about our lives should bear witness to who our dad is. Peter says in chapter 1, verse 16, be holy like Dad, so that everyone may see, not you, that you're just such a good person. They may see Dad. Problem is that throughout history we've drifted. The Jews drifted and God led them into exile to protect them from themselves so that they might come to see that they're not living in a way that was bearing reflection to him. Same thing with the early church. You know what happened 1700 years ago today? This very day, October 28th, in the year 312, Constantine entered into the most famous battle. He had just seen a vision the night before of the cross, and he had said, I am entering into battle as a Christian because our whole nation, the whole empire will be a Christian one. And what he did is he drifted. He had forgotten the words of Jesus if he'd ever known them. When your enemy strikes you, turn the other cheek. He drifted away. We too drift. We get caught up in the kingdom of the world stuff. We get caught up in making money or sex or power or the language out of our mouths or the pace of our lives. We get caught up in all these things. That what happens is we bear witness to God and we bear false witness. And Peter says, Cameron, he chose you. But he chose you to live in a certain way so that you would bear witness to the good things about who he is. Listen to how Peter says it. Continuing on in chapter 2, verse 10. Once you were not a people, but now you're the people of God. Once you had not received mercy, but now you've received mercy. Dear friends, I urge you. I urge you as foreigners and exiles, abstain from sinful desires which wage war against your soul. Live such good lives among the pagans that they, though they accuse you of doing wrong, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day he visits us. Submit yourselves for the Lord's sake. Every human authority, whether to the emperor or the supreme authority, or to the governors who are sent by him to punish those who do wrong and to commend those who do right. For it is God's will that by doing good you should silence the ignorant talk of foolish people. You have a new dad and a new way of living. Jesus came to demonstrate that new way of living. He came to empower us so that we too might live in a way that honors dad. I love that C.S. Lewis quote. Every single time that I settle for behaving in such a way that it's me in charge, it's kingdom of the world stuff, I hear C.S. Lewis words when he says, Cameron, stop settling for making mud pies in the gutter. Jesus invites you to come make sandcastles at the beach. Friends, let's respond as we sing this next song with this, just this deep sense of saying, yes, Dad, I want to be like you. But you are a chosen people. He chose us. A royal priesthood, a holy nation, meaning be like Dad. And then he says in 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 9, a people belonging to God. What does he mean by that? I don't know how many of you, if somebody said, hey, you got to go share your faith with somebody. How many of you sort of, the hair stands up behind your neck and you get little goosebumps and there's this sense of, oh no, I'm a little bit fearful and trembling. I remember sitting with some of the dads from Matthew's soccer team a number of years ago and, you know, we were just meeting each other for the first time and it went around the table sort of like, what do you do? Oh, I'm a plumber. How long have you been a plumber? Such and such and tell the story. Let me go to the next person. What do? I'm an accountant. Great. How long have you been? It goes around. And you know what's coming, right? I'm sitting there at the table and I'm thinking, oh, would the earth just open up and swallow me up before it gets to my turn? So, Cam, what do? My job is that I'm a pastor. Well, the table's cleared within 5 minutes. It's all gone, right? There's this sense that somehow it's just difficult. Well, I don't know what your job is. And sometimes people say, well, I got a great job. I'm really important. And other people say, well, my job's kind of menial and it's not really that big a deal and I don't draw so much value out of it. In fact, I'm even unemployed and I don't... Peter says, I don't care. Your job isn't what gives you value. It's your vocation. And there's a huge difference. He said, it doesn't matter whether you're a plumber, an architect, or even a pastor. That's not what gives you value. It's your vocation. You're a people belonging to God. You have a new father, a new way of living. And by the way, your father has invited you to join the family business. That's what that word means. That word laos, where Peter's there saying a people belonging to God. That's the word. And it means you've been invited to join the family business. Invited to get on the team. He's given you a role to play. Jesus invites us. Not only does Jesus come and demonstrate how we're to live so that we imitate the Father, Jesus comes and he says, come, follow me. Jesus doesn't say, come, stand here around me and just worship me forever. He says, come, follow me. Why? Because he's moving constantly from place to place, person to person, because he longs for, he desires, he knows what the family business is. It's that he says, come, I want to introduce you to my dad. He doesn't say, hey, come, let's go to church on Sunday. Or in those days, come, let's go to the synagogue. He doesn't say that. He says, I want to introduce you to my dad. Because he chooses you too for a whole new way of living. He did it with Peter. Peter, who wrote this. I mean, Peter gets this. He knows it. He did it with Peter that day on the beach. Peter's been fishing all night long. Caught nothing. Nets got holes in him. He's fixing them. He's grumpy. He's moody. I mean, just don't get in his way because it's been a horrible day at the office. Jesus comes, sets out on the boat, sits in the boat and speaks to the crowd. Then he comes in after and he says, "Hey, Peter, I know it's 11 o'clock in the morning, but I think you should go fishing again." "Yeah, right. You don't fish at 11 o'clock." "Yeah, but Peter, I think you should go out into the lake and fish again." "All right, Lord, it's you. I'll do it." And you know the story, he catches more fish than he could ever imagine. What does he do? He takes off his shirt and he dives in the water and he swims back to the shore and he falls at the feet of Jesus and he goes, "Lord, I'm not worthy." "Peter, you're saying that to me because I gave you the best day at the office." That's nothing. Your job is nothing compared to a vocation I'm going to give you. Instead of you fishing for fish, important, but it's nothing compared to now I'm going to make you a local missionary. I'm going to teach you to fish for people. Friends, whether you're a clerk in a store, whether you're a teacher, whether you're sweeping the streets, it matters not. What matters is that we know that He chose us. He chose us to live a certain way, and He chooses us to send us. You cannot be a follower of Jesus. You cannot be part of this new family, this new story, without fully understanding that the most important thing of our lives is that we are local missionaries. That's who I am. Say, but I'm still scared. So am I. I'm not an evangelist. But I believe that when we understand that, when we come to grips with being local missionaries, it gives us the words, it gives us the opportunities, and it's more fun than we could ever imagine. You've heard, some of you have heard this story before. John Ortberg tells it about his friend who's a pastor. It's a brilliant story. It captures really the essence of what it means to know that this is who we are. Listen to how he tells the story in his book. "The spirit began to brood over the face of the deep. Order and power emerged from chaos. A voice in a whisper reminded me, 'Let him who boasts, boast in the Lord.'" He's talking about his friend who's sitting on a plane, struggling with whether he'll have this conversation. So he says, "Well, it's interesting," as he turned to his seatmate, "it's interesting that we have similar business interests. You're in the body-changing business. I'm in the personality-changing business. We apply basic theocratic principles to accomplish indigenous personality modification." He was hooked, but I knew he would never admit it. "Pride is powerful. You know, I've heard of that," he replied hesitantly. "But you have an office here in the city." "Huh, we have many offices. We have offices up and down the state. In fact, we're national. We have at least one office in every state of the Union, including Alaska and Hawaii." This puzzled look on his face, searching his mind to identify this huge company he must have read about or heard about somewhere, maybe in the Wall Street Journal. "As a matter of fact," he continued, "we've gone international. Management has a plan to put at least one office in every country of the world by the end of this business era." I paused. "You have that in your business?" "Oh, no, not yet," he answered. "But you mentioned management. How does that work? How do they make it work?" "It's a family concern," I said. "There's a father and a son, and while they run everything." "It must take a lot of capital," he asked. "You mean money?" "Yes, I suppose so. No one just knows how much it takes, though. But we never worry about it because there's never a shortage. The boss always seems to have enough. He's a very creative guy, and the money as well, it's just there. In fact, those of us in the organization have a saying about our boss. He owns the cattle on a thousand hills." "Oh, he's into ranching, too," asked my captain friend. "No, it's just a saying we use to indicate his wealth." My friend sat back in his seat. "What about you?" he asked. "The employees? There's something to see," I said. "They have a spirit that pervades the whole organization. It works like this. The father and son love each other so much their love filters down through the organization so that we all find ourselves loving one another too. I know this sounds old-fashioned in a world like ours, but I have people in the organization who are willing to die for me." "You have that in your business?" I was almost shouting now. People were starting to shift uncomfortably in their seats. "Not yet," he said, quickly changing strategies. He said, "But do you have good benefits?" "Benefits? Ah, they're substantial," I countered with a gleam. "I've complete life insurance, even fire insurance. All the basics. You might not believe this, but it's true. I have holdings in a mansion that's being built for me right now for my retirement. Do you have that in your business?" "Not yet," he answered wistfully. The light was dawning. "You know, one thing bothers me. I've read journals, and if your business is at all you say that it is, why haven't I heard about it before now?" "It's a good question," I said. "After all, we have a 2,000-year-old tradition. Want to sign up?" Some of my privilege of traveling to different churches across the country, I've started asking the question, how many people in your church understand that the invitation, when Jesus chooses us, invites us to live a certain way? How many people understand that the call to a new vocation is around their call to be a local missionary? I think the highest number that I've heard, one church maybe had up to 40%. But most churches were around about 10%. Friends, if there's anything you hear today, He chose you. But He chose you not to sin. He didn't choose you to sit on the sideline like I might have done when I was 8 years old and didn't get picked on the good team. He chose you to participate in the game. We're going to participate in all kinds of different ways, but He has a role for each one of us to engage when we see ourselves as local missionaries. Not fishers of fish, but fishers of people. It doesn't matter your job, because your vocation, our vocation, our purpose, is that we've joined the family business, that we might introduce all of our friends, teammates, classmates, neighbors, to Dad.